welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. John Brown wasn't a lunatic who heard voices from God. Christopher Columbus did nothing to deserve a national holiday. And the Pilgrims weren't actually referred to as Pilgrims until the 1870s. At least that's what Professor James Lowen tells us in his two recently published books, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong, and Lies Across America, What Our Historic Sites Get Wrong. Lowen will be our guest this week and next to talk about both of these books, which, as you might imagine, have attracted a lot of attention. We'll also hear from Michael Nelson, a professor at Rhodes College, who examines the recent controversies involving several best-selling historical writers, from which he draws conclusions on how academic historians may have gotten off track. But before we get to James Lowen and Michael Nelson, let's hear from Joey Skidmore about an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on February 19, 1807, Aaron Burr, former Vice President of the United States, was arrested for treason. Born in Newark, New Jersey in 1756, Aaron Burr graduated from the college in New Jersey, which is now known as Princeton University. He served in the Continental Army and entered politics. In the presidential election of 1800, Burr and Thomas Jefferson defeated the incumbent, John Adams, but they tied in the electoral vote, so the contest had to be decided in the House of Representatives. When former Secretary of State Alexander Hamilton threw his influence behind Jefferson, Jefferson was elected. But under the electoral rules of the day, Burr became his vice president. It was not a happy union, and in 1804, Burr was dropped from the ticket. Burr ran for governor of New York, but again faced opposition from a faction led by Alexander Hamilton. This time he challenged Hamilton to a duel and shot him to death on July 11, 1804. Burr was indicted for murder, but he fled to avoid arrest and actually finished his term in office as vice president. Burr then left for New Orleans, where, it was alleged, he and General James Wilkinson made plans to raise a private army to grab land from Spain and the southwestern part of the U.S. On February 19, 1807, Burr was arrested for treason, but he was found not guilty. To avoid any further prosecution, he fled to Europe, where he remained until all charges against him were dropped, whereupon he returned to live quietly the rest of his life in New York.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, on a November morning in 1864, U.S. Army Colonel John Chivington and 700 volunteers massacred nearly 200 Cheyenne and Arapaho Indians and camped along a dry creek bed in southeastern Colorado. Most of the victims were women and children. The Sand Creek Massacre, as it came to be known, sparked two decades of warfare between Native Americans and the U.S. Army and left a bitter legacy thereafter. In 1999, Colorado Senator Ben Knight Horse Campbell sponsored a bill that directed the National Park Service to find the massacre's exact location. Well, the Park Service has found the site, about 50 miles north of Lamar and 150 miles southwest of Denver, and it has been designated a National Historic Site. And in another report, this one by the BBC, historians are now speculating that Mary Queen of Scots, whom some thought had periodic bouts of madness, may well have suffered from porphyria, the same disease that afflicted Mary's descendant, England's King George III. The disease affects the nervous system and causes mental disorders such as depression, hallucinations, anxiety, and paranoia. Physical symptoms include muscle cramps and purple urine. This is Talking History.
Thank you.
James Loewen is on a mission to debunk myths, correct errors, and set the record straight concerning American history as presented in the nation's textbooks and at its historic sites. Fred Nielsen, professor of history at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, spoke with Loewen about his two books on the subject, and will present that conversation in a two-part interview this week and next.
To the dead, one owes only truth, declared Voltaire. That may be the ideal, but in reality, history and truth can sometimes seem like strangers. Napoleon thought history a set of lies agreed upon. The philosopher George Santayana declared that history is a pack of lies about events that never happened, told by people who weren't there. Many of the leading American history textbooks seem to support these gloomy aphorisms. According to my guest, James Loewen, the texts used in U.S. high schools are riddled with errors, large and small. Loewen has taught at the University of Vermont and is the author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. Professor Loewen, welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
Some people would say that learning patriotism and the facts of America's past are the point of studying history. Yet you indict textbooks for being blindly patriotic and for containing too many facts. What's the problem?
Well, the first question might be, what do we mean by patriotism? There's some quote by Frederick Douglass, goes something like this. I call him, he was of course writing in the pre-gender correct days, I call him the true patriot who rebukes his country for its sins rather than excusing them. If we mean by patriot what I would call nationalist, namely the person who says, well, America's right no matter what and I'm not going to think about it, well, then perhaps the textbooks do try to inculcate that kind of let's call it nationalism. I don't want to call it patriotism. The other thing that they seem to be trying to do, and the way that teachers teach them seems to be trying to do this too, is to teach what I call twig history. And what I mean by that is we're not teaching the forest for the trees. We're not even teaching trees. We're teaching twigs, just isolated, disconnected facts, 8,000 of them maybe, or who knows how many, that students are supposed to memorize and remember, and then they somehow learned American history. And the problem there is, first of all, that it doesn't work. That is, if our game in teaching history, if our intent is to get students to remember 8,000 of these twigs, we're failing. And we show this every so often. I think last year there was a study by NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, that showed that students are further behind other nations in American history than they are even in math and science, where they are always getting a woeful report card. So I think that the way to teach twigs, ironically, is not by teaching twigs. When we just plain teach twigs, students just plain become bored and don't like history and forget it all as soon as they can.
Well, it can be said, and I think you put it this way at one point in your book, that history, if taken too far in the fact direction, becomes nothing but one damn fact after another.
This happened. That's how we're doing it.
Textbooks often engage in what you call heroification. Columbus is an example of someone whose flaws textbooks often overlook. And the books, as you point out, often get many basic facts about him wrong.
Yeah, I would say that the textbooks make two terrible errors in teaching Columbus. First of all, they leave out everything important that he did. I mean, his importance, if you think about it, comes from what he did not in 1492, because in 1492 he didn't really do anything that Leif Erikson hadn't done or his followers hadn't done in about 1002 or 1003. In fact, they, of course, the Norse or the Vikings, actually got to North America, which Columbus never did, and they set up a colony here for two or three years, and they reported back and did all kinds of things. Certainly Columbus didn't do that in 1492, but in 1493 he did something unprecedented, and that is he got outfitted by the King and Queen of Spain with 17 ships, with 1,000 to 2,000 soldiers, with attack dogs, with horses, with armor, with cannons, and he proceeds to take over the island of Haiti and, of course, rename it Hispaniola. Now, I don't think any country had ever taken over a colony on the other side of an ocean before. And this was, of course, just a stepping stone, and it led to Mexico and Peru and so on. This was new. So the significance of Columbus comes from 1493. Textbooks miss it. And the second thing that they miss is they tell us all manner of falsehoods about 1492 and about the Columbus at the end of his life, for that matter. And they're not really very important. They're mostly just kind of funny. I mean, the silliest of all, which I'm sure many, many listeners will have heard, is the idea that people thought the world was flat. And Columbus, in fact, had to face down a near mutiny from his sailors who were afraid of sailing off the edge of the flat earth. This is just silly, and in fact, I traced it down. It turns out the flat earth myth was established by none other than Washington Irving in about 1830. You remember, he's the novelist who wrote The Legend of Sleepy Hollow and all that. And in 1830 or so, he told the flat earth story in his three-volume biography of Christopher Columbus, which was the most popular biography published in the entire 19th century, stayed in print throughout the century. And textbooks latched onto it, and at least one of them repeats it to this day, even though it was just completely false. Sailors literally can see the roundness of the earth because a ship, after all, goes over the horizon. I mean, just even the language gives it away. Goes over the horizon and disappears hull first, and then the little sails, and finally the tiny little flag up at the top. It's the last thing you see. If it was flat, of course, it wouldn't do that. It would become littler and littler and littler, and finally it would become a dot, and then the dot would vanish. So they knew full well that the world was round. They knew all kinds of other things that the textbooks get wrong about them and about the whole voyage.
You've asked college students when the country that we know as the United States was first settled. The most popular answer seems to be 1620, the year the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth. That suggests the power of what you call an origin myth. Not necessarily true, but prevalent nonetheless.
I've gotten that, of course, in New England, but I've even had audiences in Virginia, of all places, and Chicago settle upon 1620 as their first answer to the question. And 1620 leaves out a few folks. I mean, the first folks it leaves out, of course, are the Indians. And I've had students actually tell me why they didn't think to put Indian. It's because the way I asked the question, I thought it was quite generous. I didn't say, when was the United States first settled? I said, when was the country we now know as the United States first settled. But still, they wouldn't say Indians because of the word settled. Indians roamed, that was their stereotype. Of course, Indians roamed primarily after white folks got here and burned down their orchards and tore up their cornfields and forced them to roam. But 80% of the Indians before white folks arrived and black folks arrived were settled agricultural Indians. But we don't think of them that way. So that's the first people they leave out. Then, of course, the 1620 answer leaves out the Spanish, who were here even in what's now the United States. They were in Florida and they were in New Mexico way before 1620. And then it leaves out the Dutch, who were here before 1620, the French, but even the British. If speaking English is what we mean by settle, we certainly have 1607 as an example in Virginia. So why do they say 1620? I conclude it's because 1620 is the nice founding of the United States. These folks are said to not be in it for the money. They were in it for religious freedom. Aren't we all in favor of freedom, religious and otherwise? The Pilgrims didn't do anything really bad, and so that's when we wanted, and so that is our origin myth, I think.
You quote the historian Francis Fitzgerald as having said that textbooks tend to leave out ideas, even those ideas with which the authors might agree with, making American history to a large extent mindless. What are some examples of ideas being absent from American textbooks where one might expect them to be there?
Well, there's lots of examples we could pick. Let me pick on what I think is the most famous series of debates in the United States, and I've asked dozens of audiences across the United States, what is that? And folks seem to agree, and I think they're right. It's the Lincoln-Douglas debates. So I then proceed to read them a typical paragraph from the Lincoln-Douglas debates. The textbooks, incidentally, agree that the Lincoln-Douglas debates are the most important debates in the history of the United States. I'm a sociologist, and we count things, and so I can tell you that the average textbook of the 12 that I examined devotes 7 paragraphs and 2 photographs to the Lincoln-Douglas debates, even though they actually were for senator from the state of Illinois in 1858. And I think they're right in giving it so much space, but that's because of the ideas that were in them. Because in these debates, the two contestants, Stephen A. Douglas for the Democrats and Abraham Lincoln for the Republicans, set forth for their respective party what their position was going to be on the key issue of the day, which was, of course, slavery, and the role black people were likely to play in the United States. So what did the textbooks do? Well, they talk all about how Douglas was a flashy dresser. He was shorter than Lincoln. He had a low-pitched voice. Lincoln's voice was high-pitched. Let me read you just a couple of sentences. Douglas was fighting for his political life. No greater contrast could be imagined than the one between Lincoln and Douglas. The latter was really a little giant physically, while Lincoln, when standing erect, towered to 6 feet 4 inches. Lincoln, awkward in posture and leaning a little forward, stood calm, dot, dot, dot. What they don't do is they don't quote Lincoln. They don't quote Douglas. In fact, all 12 textbooks that I looked at combined give us exactly 3 sentence fragments from Stephen A. Douglas, one of which is, for instance, for a day or an hour, and that's it. So the ideas of the Lincoln-Douglas debate, which are profound and important, it's basically Douglas in favor of white supremacy, flatly, and Lincoln in favor of a gradual extension of the equalitarianism of the Declaration of Independence, these ideas never reach students.
That has an effect on the presentation of the Civil War, too. The war is fought, but it's not quite clear, you suggest in the books, why it's fought. Nobody, at least as far as the textbooks present it, fought to preserve racial slavery, and nobody fought to end it.
Yeah, I think that in this the period I call the nadir of American race relations, this period maybe 1890 to 1930 or so, when the Ku Klux Klan rose to its height and lynchings were high and the last Native American tribes lost their independence, and it was really a terrible time in terms of race relations in the U.S. During that period, we got our interpretation of the Civil War set, both in our textbooks and also on the landscape. And it's set as a contest between moral equals. Well, of course, nowadays, since slavery is possibly practiced a little bit in places in Pakistan and Northwest Africa, and that's it, we're not in favor of slavery. So we cannot make the Civil War a contest between moral equals, North and South, if slavery has anything to do with it. And so during that era, 1890 to 1930, the Civil War got renamed, of course. For a while there, it was called the War Between the States, and which nobody called it in the 1860s. It became this contest of two moral equals. In fact, I would argue between 1890 and 1930, in a way, the South, the Confederate South, really won the Civil War. But in any case, the textbooks are still copying the interpretation of that earlier era. And so basically, the position of the South is just completely mystified. Why were they fighting? It's just not clear.
One might expect that students would be more drawn to recent events. And it's rather surprising then that the textbooks often give short shrift to recent history, even slighting the Civil War, the Vietnam War, for example. Why is that?
Well, I'm not quite sure why it is, because I wasn't in the minds of the authors. But I will say that the textbooks do a terrible job on the Vietnam War, and even in some ways a worse job on things of that same era, like, for instance, the recent women's movement. And I think, I ought to add one other thing, teachers, on the whole, do even a worse job. The average teacher still doesn't even get to the war in Vietnam, but the class peters out somewhere around World War II. Now, since I took American history in 1959, for the class to peter out around World War II, as ours did, that wasn't so bad. But 1945 is by now almost 60 years ago, and so we're missing a whole lot of our past if we let the class peter out at World War II. Now, what do they do with Vietnam? Well, I could have assessed the textbook's Vietnam chapters by coming up with my own interpretation of what they should say about the war in Vietnam, and I do have such an interpretation, and then critiquing them when they differ from it. But I've kind of concluded that would be pretty subjective. So instead what I did was I looked at the visual representation. This was, after all, the most photographed and televised war in our history, not accepting the more recent Gulf War and so on. And there are several images. I came up with a list of 7 that were absolutely paramount, that even made history. The little girl running naked, having been napalmed, toward the camera, for instance, with a little boy off to her side. Everyone recognizes that image who lived through the period, and many people know that image who were born after the period. The Saigon police chief, he's actually called the National Police Chief of Vietnam, executing casually a suspected Viet Cong with his pistol at an intersection in Saigon. That's a famous image, and so on. The evacuation from the U.S. embassy. So I picked seven of these images, and I looked at the 12 textbooks to see whether they included them or anything like them. One out of 12 had one of these pictures. The other 11 didn't have any. And just for the record, in the newer edition of that one book, which I think was the American Pageant, it dropped that one image. So we're seeing a deliberate softening of any of the war images and a softening and very cautious description of the war. I think it's because that might be controversial. There are still some people who think we should have gone in there and won the war with atomic weapons, and there are other people thinking this war was an outrage, and the textbooks just kind of would rather not ruffle those waters.
We have only about a minute remaining. As we conclude, I wonder, what are the consequences of having the textbooks that we do?
I think that they make us stupid. I think specifically they make high school students conclude not that the United States has always been perfect, that all of our leaders have always been heroes, and so on. I think high school students conclude that history, as taught in most of our schools, is not a very serious subject. And so when they go on to college, of course, some students don't go to college, and when they do go on to college, they avoid history like the plague, and so only about one out of every six students ever takes a course in history after they leave high school. So thus, these errors and misinterpretations and failures to think that are encouraged in high school never get corrected afterwards.
Well, Professor Loewen, thanks for visiting with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I've been talking with James Loewen, the author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong.
Lies.
Historical writing by both academics and best-selling authors has come under intense scrutiny lately. Some have been accused of plagiarism, others with outright fabrication. Popular writers charge academics with failure to communicate with general readers, while academics charge the best-selling authors with doing superficial work. In our commentary of the week, Michael Nelson reflects on the controversy and draws some lessons from it on the state of historical writing. Nelson is a professor of political science at Rhodes College.
What a bad time it has been for the nation's best-known historians, that small number of academic scholars whose faces frequently appear on television and whose speaking fees reach well into the five figures. It's a small roster, Stephen Ambrose, Joseph Ellis, Doris Kearns Goodwin. Yet in the past year, all three of them have been caught in offenses ranging from plagiarism to outright fabrication. Let's start with Ambrose. The issue with him is not that he made facts up. No, what he did is foster the illusion that he was the facts discoverer he plagiarized from other authors. Ambrose has been revealed to be a serial plagiarist, dating back to the early 70s. No one has accused Doris Kearns Goodwin of being a serial plagiarist, just an ordinary one. In writing her 1987 book, The Fitzgeralds and the Kennedys, Goodwin stole extensively from a biography of Kathleen Kennedy by a British writer. What gave the Goodwin story legs was less the deed itself than her attempts to explain it away. Instead of making the reasonable claim that the statute of limitations had surely run out on a 15-year-old, one-time offense, Goodwin couldn't stop rationalizing. Absolutely not, she told the Boston Globe when she was charged with plagiarism. She'd just been a little sloppy. But as Thomas Mallon has pointed out, sloppiness is the first excuse claimed by the plagiarist. The sad story of Joseph Ellis takes us more directly into the realm of historians making up facts. The Ellis affair began with the publication of a story in the Boston Globe detailing the lies he was telling about himself in his classes. In the life that Ellis fabricated, he'd scored the winning touchdown in his final high school football game. He'd spent a summer doing civil rights work in Mississippi. He'd fought in Vietnam as a paratrooper, then joined the anti-war movement. None of Ellis's boasts were true. He wasn't even on his high school football team. His time in Mississippi had not been spent working for civil rights. He never served in Vietnam, nor was he involved in the anti-war movement. For all his many and genuine accomplishments as a historian, Ellis was just a pathetic old guy trying to make young college students think he was cool. So what's the big lesson that ties together the sad stories of Joseph Ellis, Stephen Ambrose, and Doris Kearns Goodwin? Nothing terribly original, but how about dusting off this old chestnut? Seeing and telling the truth as best one can is the highest scholarly calling. Ambrose and Goodwin betrayed that calling by stealing the work of others and passing it off as their own. Ellis betrayed it by making things up and portraying those things as true. In each case, scholars whose accomplishments as tellers of truth are otherwise distinguished got seriously off track, and in each case, and deservedly, they have paid the price in the coin of tarnished reputation.
You've been listening to Michael Nelson, professor of political science at Rhodes College and the author of Governing Gambling and the American Presidency, Origins and Development, 1776 to 2002. And finally, we call to your attention three new historical exhibits at the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design. Here to tell you about them is Talking History's Fiona Beatty.
The William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is currently showing three exhibits that focus on different aspects of popular culture in the 20th century. The first, which runs through May the 11th, focuses on the golden age of radio, the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. Visitors are presented with information on product advertising and program sponsorship, as well as treated to reenactments of various vintage radio programs featuring such comedians as Burns and Allen, Jack Benny and Bob Hope. Also at the museum until June the 15th is Groovy Ads, Psychedelics from the 60s. This exhibit displays examples of and examines the psychedelic graphics used in advertising during that decade, from rock and roll to household products. And finally, if you go to the Eisner Museum before June the 15th, you can also take in Up in Smoke, a politically incorrect look at cigarette advertising through the 20th century. It is the first exhibit to explore the best of both pro- and anti-smoking campaigns and their influence on American culture. Again, all three of these exhibits are currently at the Eisner Museum of Advertising in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments or suggestions, either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore is the producer, Fiona Beatty, our assistant producer. And you can learn more about the show and the Organization of American Historians at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.